Had that part been in control during the missing 7 minutes? Susanna was afraid it had been. If so, it was gone now. Had taken back its legs and just walked off on them into New York circa 1977. Not good. But it had taken her fear of the rose with it, and that was good. She didn't want to be afraid of something that felt so strong and so wonderful. Another personality? Are you thinking the lady who brought the legs was another personality? Another version of Detta Walker, in other words? The idea made her feel like screaming. She thought she now understood how a woman would feel if 5 years or so after an apparently successful cancer operation, the doctor told her a routine X-ray had picked up a shadow on her lung. "Not again," she murmured in a low, frantic voice as a fresh group of pedestrians scooted past. They all moved away from the board fence a little, although it reduced the space between them considerably. "No, not again. It can't be. I'm whole. I'm fixed." How long had her friends been gone? She looked down street at the flashing clock. It said 8:42, but she wasn't sure she could trust it. It felt longer than that, much longer. Maybe she should call to them, just give a hello. "How y'all doing in there?" "No, no such thing. You're a gunslinger, girl. At least that's what he says, what he thinks. And you're not going to change what he thinks by hollering like a schoolgirl just seen a garter snake under a bush. You're just going to sit here and wait. You can do it. You've got Oi for company, and you..." Then she saw the man standing on the other side of the street, just standing there beside a newsstand. He was naked. A ragged Y-cut, sewn up with large black industrial stitches, began at his groin, rose, and branched at his sternum. His empty eyes gazed at her, through the world. Any possibility that this might only have been a hallucination ended when Oi began to bark. He was staring directly across at the naked dead man. Susanna gave up her silence and began to scream for Eddie. 14. When the rose opened, disclosing the scarlet furnace within its petals and the yellow sun burning at the center, Eddie saw everything that mattered.
"Oh, my Lord,"
Jake sighed from beside him, but he might have been 1,000 miles away. Eddie saw great things and near misses. Albert Einstein as a child, not quite struck by a runaway milk wagon as he crossed a street. A teenage boy named Albert Schweitzer getting out of a bathtub and not quite stepping on the cake of soap lying beside the pulled plug. A Nazi Oberleutnant burning a piece of paper with the date and place of the D-Day invasion written on it. He saw a man who intended to poison the entire water supply of Denver die of a heart attack in a roadside rest stop on I-80 in Iowa with a bag of McDonald's French fries on his lap. He saw a terrorist wired up with explosives suddenly turn away from a crowded restaurant in a city that might have been Jerusalem. The terrorist had been transfixed by nothing more than the sky and the thought that it arced above the just and unjust alike. He saw 4 men rescue a little boy from a monster whose entire head seemed to consist of a single eye. But more important than any of these was the vast, accretive weight of small things, from planes which hadn't crashed to men and women who had come to the correct place at the perfect time and thus founded generations. He saw kisses exchanged in doorways and wallets returned and men who had come to a splitting of the way and chosen the right fork. He saw 1,000 random meetings that weren't random, 10,000 right decisions, 100,000 right answers, 1,000,000 acts of unacknowledged kindness. He saw the old people of River Crossing and Roland kneeling in the dust for Aunt Talitha's blessing. Again, heard her giving it freely and gladly. Heard her telling him to lay the cross she had given him at the foot of the dark tower and speak the name of Talitha Unwin at the far end of the earth. He saw the tower itself in the burning folds of the rose and for a moment understood its purpose, how it distributed its lines of force to all the worlds that were and held them steady in time's great helix. For every brick that landed on the ground instead of some little kid's head, for every tornado that missed the trailer park, for every missile that didn't fly, for every hand stayed from violence, there was the tower. And the quiet, singing voice of the rose. The song that promised all might be well. All might be well. That all manner of things might be well. But something's wrong with it, he thought. There was a jagged dissonance buried in the hum like bits of broken glass. There was a nasty, flickering purple glare in its hot heart, some cold light that did not belong there. There are two hubs of existence, he heard Roland say. Two. Like Jake, he could have been 1,000 miles away. The tower and the rose. Yet they are the same. The same, Jake agreed. His face was painted with brilliant light, dark red and bright yellow. Yet Eddie thought he could see that other light as well, a flickering purple reflection like a bruise. Now it danced on Jake's forehead, now on his cheek, now it swam in the well of his eye, now gone, now reappearing at his temple like the physical manifestation of a bad idea. What's wrong with it? Eddie heard himself ask, but there was no answer. Not from Roland or Jake, not from the rose. Jake raised one finger and began to count. Counting petals, Eddie saw, but there was really no need to count. They all knew how many petals there were. We must have this patch, Roland said. Own it, and then protect it. Until the beams are reestablished and the tower is made safe again, because while the tower weakens, this is what holds everything together. And this is weakening, too. It's sick. Do you feel it? Eddie opened his mouth to say of course he felt it. And that was when Susanna began to scream. A moment later, Oi joined his voice to hers, barking wildly. Eddie, Jake and Roland looked at each other like sleepers awakened from the deepest of dreams. Eddie made it to his feet first. He turned and stumbled back toward the fence and Second Avenue, shouting her name. Jake followed, pausing only long enough to snatch something out of the snarl of burdocks where the key had been before. Roland spared one final agonized look at the wild rose growing so bravely here in this tumbled wasteland of bricks and boards and weeds and litter. It had already begun to furl its petals again, hiding the light that blazed within. I'll come back, he told it. I swear by the gods of all the worlds, by my mother and father, and my friends that were, that I'll come back. Yet he was afraid. Roland turned and ran for the board fence, picking his way through the tumbled litter with unconscious agility in spite of the pain in his hip. As he ran, one thought returned to him and beat at his mind like a heart. Two hubs of existence. The rose and the tower. The tower and the rose. All the rest was held between them, spinning in fragile complexity. 15. Eddie threw himself over the fence, landed badly and asprawl, leaped to his feet, and stepped in front of Susanna without even thinking. Oi continued to bark.
Suze, what? What is it?
He reached for Roland's gun and found nothing. It seemed that guns did not go todesh.
There, she cried, pointing across the street. There, do you see him? Please, Eddie, please tell me you see him.
Eddie felt the temperature of his blood plummet. What he saw was a naked man who had been cut open and then sewed up again in what could only be an autopsy tattoo. Another man, a living one, bought a paper at the nearby newsstand, checked for traffic, then crossed Second Avenue. Although he was shaking open the paper to look at the headline as he did it, Eddie saw the way he swerved around the dead man. The way people swerved around us, he thought.
There was another one, too. She whispered. A woman. She was walking, and there was a worm. I saw a worm crawling.
Look to your right, Jake said tightly.
He was down on one knee, stroking Oi back to quietness. In his other hand, he held a crumpled pink something. His face was as pale as cottage cheese. They looked. A child was wandering slowly toward them. It was only possible to tell it was a girl because of the red and blue dress she wore. When she got closer, Eddie saw that the blue was supposed to be the ocean. The red blobs resolved themselves into little candy-colored sailboats. Her head had been squashed in some cruel accident, squashed until it was wider than it was long. Her eyes were crushed grapes. Over one pale arm was a white plastic purse, a little girl's best I'm going to the car accident and don't know it purse. Susanna drew in breath to scream. The darkness she had only sensed earlier was now almost visible. Certainly it was palpable. It pressed against her like earth. Yet she would scream. She must scream. Scream or go mad. Not a sound. Roland of Gilead whispered in her ear. Do not disturb her, poor lost thing. For your life, Susanna. Susanna's scream expired in a long, horrified sigh. They're dead, Jake said in a thin, controlled voice. Both of them.
The vagrant dead, Roland replied. I heard of them from Alan Johns's father. It must have been not long after we returned from Magus, for after that there wasn't much more time before everything... What is it you say, Susanna, before everything went to hell in a handbasket? In any case, it was Burning Chris who warned us that if we ever went Todash, we might see Vagues. He pointed across the street where the naked dead man still stood. Such as him yonder have either died so suddenly they don't yet understand what's happened to them, or they simply refuse to accept it. Sooner or later they do go on. I don't think there are many of them.
Thank God, Eddie said. It's like something out of a George Romero zombie movie. Susanna, what happened to your legs? Jake asked. I don't know, she said. One minute I had them, and the next minute I was the same as before. She seemed to become aware of Roland's gaze and turned toward him. You see something funny, sugar?
We are quartets, Susanna. Tell us what really happened.
What the hell are you trying to imply? Eddie asked him. He might have said more, but before he could get started, Susanna grasped his arm.
Caught me out, didn't you? She asked Roland. All right, I'll tell you. According to that fancy dot clock down there, I lost 7 minutes while I was waiting for you boys. 7 minutes and my fine new legs. I didn't want to say anything because...
She faltered, then went on.
Because I was afraid I might be losing my mind.
That's not what you're afraid of, Roland thought. Not exactly. Eddie gave her a brief hug and a kiss on the cheek. He glanced nervously across the street at the nude corpse. The little girl with the squashed head had, thankfully, wandered off down 46th Street toward the United Nations. Then back at the gunslinger.
If what you said before is true, Roland, this business of time slipping its cogs is very bad news. What if instead of just 7 minutes it slips 3 months? What if the next time we get back here, Calvin Towers sold his lot? We can't let that happen. Because that rose, man, that rose.
Tears had begun to slip out of Eddie's eyes.
It's the best thing in the world, Jake said, low.
In all the worlds, Roland said. Would it ease Eddie and Jake to know that this particular time slip had probably been in Susanna's head? That Mia had come out for 7 minutes, had a look around, and then dived back into her hole like Punxsutawney Phil on Groundhog Day? Probably not. But he saw one thing in Susanna's haggard face. She either knew what was going on, or suspected very strongly. It must be hellish for her, he thought.
We have to do better than this if we're really going to change things, Jake said. This way we're not much better than Vagues ourselves.
We have to get to 64, too, Susanna said. If we're going to get hold of my dough, that is. Can we, Roland? If Callahan's got Black 13, will it work like a door?
What it will work is mischief, Roland thought. Mischief and worse. But before he could say that or anything else, the Todash chimes began. The pedestrians on 2nd Avenue heard them no more than they saw the pilgrims gathered by the board fence, but the corpse across the street slowly raised his dead hands and placed them over his dead ears, his mouth turning down in a grimace of pain. And then they could see through him.
Hold on to each other, Roland said. Jake, get your hand into Oi's fur and deep. Never mind if it hurts him.
Jake did as Roland said, the chimes digging deep into his head. Beautiful, but painful.
Like a root canal without Novocaine, Susanna said.
She turned her head, and for one moment she could see through the board fence. It had become transparent.
Beyond it was the rose, its petals now closed, but still giving off its own quietly gorgeous glow. She felt Eddie's arm slip around her shoulders. "Hold on, Suze. Whatever you do, hold on." She grasped Roland's hand. For a moment longer, she could see Second Avenue, and then everything was gone. The chimes ate up the world, and she was flying through blind darkness with Eddie's arm around her and Roland's hand squeezing her own. 16. When the darkness let them go, they were almost 40 feet down the road from their camp. Jake sat up slowly, then turned to Oi. "You all right, boy?"
"Oi."
Jake patted the bumbler's head. He looked around at the others. "All here." He sighed, relieved. "What's this?" Eddie asked. He had taken Jake's other hand when the chimes began. Now, caught in their interlocked fingers, was a crumpled pink object. It felt like cloth. It also felt like metal. "I don't know," Jake said. "You picked it up in the lot just after Susanna screamed," Roland said. "I saw you." Jake nodded. "Yeah, I guess maybe I did, because it was where the key was before."
"What is it, sugar?"
"Some kind of bag." He held it by the straps. "I'd say it was my bowling bag, but that's back at the Lanes with my ball inside it, back in 1977.
"What's written on the side?" Eddie asked.
But they couldn't make it out. The clouds had closed in again, and there was no moonlight. They walked back to their camp together, slowly, shaky as invalids, and Roland built up the fire. Then they looked at the writing on the side of the rose-pink bowling bag. "Nothing but strikes at Midworld Lanes," was what it said.
"That's not right," Jake said. "Almost, but not quite. What it says on my bag is nothing but strikes at Midtown Lanes.
Timmy gave it to me one day when I bowled a 282. He said I wasn't old enough for him to buy me a beer."
"A bowling gunslinger," Eddie said, and shook his head. "Wonders never cease, do they?"
Susanna took the bag and ran her hands over it.
"What kind of weave is this? Feels like metal and it's heavy."
Roland, who had an idea what the bag was for, although not who or what had left it for them, said, "Put it in your knapsack with the books, Jake, and keep it very safe."
"What do we do next?" Eddie asked.
"Sleep," Roland said. "I think we're going to be very busy for the next few weeks. We'll have to take our sleep when and where we find it."
"But
sleep," Roland said, and spread out his skins. Eventually they did, and all of them dreamed of the rose. Except for Mia, who got up in the night's last dark hour and slipped away to feast in the great banquet hall. And there she feasted very well. She was, after all, eating for two. Part 2. Telling Tales. Chapter 1. The Pavilion. 1. If anything about the ride into Colubrin Sturgis surprised Eddie, it was how easily and naturally he took to horseback. Unlike Susanna and Jake, who had both ridden at summer camp, Eddie had never even petted a horse. When he'd heard the clop of approaching hooves on the morning after what he thought of as Toadash number 2, he'd felt a sharp pang of dread. It wasn't the riding he was afraid of, or the animals themselves. It was the possibility, hell, the strong probability, of looking like a fool. What kind of gunslinger had never ridden a horse? Yet Eddie still found time to pass a word with Roland before they came.
"It wasn't the same last night."
Roland raised his eyebrows.
"It wasn't 19 last night."
"What do you mean?"
"I don't know what I mean."
"I don't know either," Jake put in, "but he's right. Last night New York felt like the real deal. I mean, I know we were Toadash, but still..."
"Real," Roland had mused.
And Jake, smiling, said,
"Real as roses."
2. The Slightmans were at the head of the Kala's party this time, each leading a pair of mounts by long hacks. There was nothing very intimidating about the horses of Colubrin Sturgis.
Certainly they weren't much like the ones Eddie had imagined galloping along the drop in Roland's tale of long-ago mages. These beasts were stubby, sturdy-legged creatures with shaggy coats and large, intelligent eyes. They were bigger than Shetland ponies, but a very long cast from the fiery-eyed stallions he had been expecting. Not only had they been saddled, but a proper bedroll had been lashed to each mount. As Eddie walked toward his, he didn't need to be told which it was, he knew, the roan, all his doubts and worries fell away. He only asked a single question directed at Ben Sleitman the younger after examining the stirrups.
These are going to be too short for me, Ben. Can you show me how to make them longer?
When the boy dismounted to do it himself, Eddie shook his head. It'd be best if I learned, he said, and with no embarrassment at all. As the boy showed him, Eddie realized he didn't really need the lesson. He saw how it was done almost as soon as Benny's fingers flipped up the stirrup, revealing the leather tug in back. This wasn't like hidden subconscious knowledge, and it didn't strike him as anything supernatural either. It was just that, with the horse a warm and fragrant reality before him, he understood how everything worked. He'd only had one experience exactly like this since coming to Midworld, and that had been the first time he'd strapped on one of Roland's guns.
"Need help, sugar?" Susanna asked. "Just pick me up if I go off on the other side," he grunted, but of course he didn't do any such thing.
The horse stood steady, swaying just the slightest bit as Eddie stepped into the stirrup and then swung into the plain Black Ranch Hand's saddle. Jake asked Benny if he had a poncho. The foreman's son looked doubtfully up at the cloudy sky.
"I really don't think it's going to rain," he said. "It's often like this for days around Reaptide. I want it for Oi."
Perfectly calm, perfectly certain. He feels exactly like I do, Eddie thought, as if he's done this 1,000 times before.
The boy drew a rolled oilskin from one of his saddlebags and handed it to Jake, who thanked him, put it on, and then tucked Oi into the capacious pocket which ran across the front like a kangaroo's pouch. There wasn't a single protest from the bumbler either. Eddie thought, if I told Jake I'd expected Oi to trot along behind us like a sheepdog, would he say he always rides like this? No, but he might think it.
As they set off, Eddie realized what all this reminded him of. Stories he'd heard of reincarnation. He had tried to shake the idea off to reclaim the practical, tough-minded Brooklyn boy who had grown up in Henry Dean's shadow and wasn't quite able to do it. The thought of reincarnation might have been less unsettling if it had come to him head-on, but it didn't. What he thought was that he couldn't be from Roland's line, simply couldn't. Not unless Arthur Eld had at some point stopped by Co-op City, that was. Like maybe for a red hot and a piece of Dolly Lundgren's fried dough, stupid to project such an idea from the ability to ride an obviously docile horse without lessons. Yet the idea came back at odd moments through the day and had followed him down into sleep last night. The Eld. The line of the Eld.
3. They nooned in the saddle, and while they were eating popkins and drinking cold coffee, Jake eased his mount in next to Roland's. Oi peered at the gunslinger with bright eyes from the front pocket of the poncho. Jake was feeding the bumbler pieces of his popkin, and there were crumbs caught in Oi's whiskers.
"Roland, may I speak to you as Dean?"
Jake sounded slightly embarrassed.
"Of course."
Roland drank coffee and then looked at the boy, interested, all the while rocking contentedly back and forth in the saddle.
"Ben, that is, both Sleitmans, but mostly the kid, asked if I'd come and stay with him, out at the Rocking Bee."
"Do you want to go?" Roland asked.
The boy's cheeks flushed thin red.
"Well, what I thought is that if you guys were in town with the old fella, and I was out in the country, south of town, you can, then we'd get 2 different pictures of the place. My dad says you don't see anything very well if you only look at it from one viewpoint."
"True enough," Roland said, and hoped neither his voice nor his face would give away any of the sorrow and regret he suddenly felt. Here was a boy who was now ashamed of being a boy.
He had made a friend, and the friend had invited him to stay over, as friends sometimes do. Benny had undoubtedly promised that Jake could help him feed the animals and perhaps shoot his bow or his ba if it shot bolts instead of arrows. There would be places Benny would want to share, secret places he might have gone to with his twin in other times. A platform in a tree, mayhap, or a fish pond in the reeds special to him, or a stretch of riverbank where pirates of Eld were reputed to have buried gold and jewels. Such places as boys go. But a large part of Jake Chambers was now ashamed to want to do such things. This was the part that had been despoiled by the doorkeeper in Dutch Hill, by Gasher, by the TikTok man, and by Roland himself, of course. Were he to say no to Jake's request now, the boy would very likely never ask again, and never resent him for it, which was even worse. Were he to say yes in the wrong way, with even the slightest trace of indulgence in his voice, for instance, the boy would change his mind. The boy. The gunslinger realized how much he wanted to be able to go on calling Jake that, and how short the time to do so was apt to be. He had a bad feeling about Calla Bryn Sturgis. "Go with them after they dine us in the pavilion tonight," Roland said. "Go and do your fine, as they say here."
"Are you sure? Because if you think you might need me—"
"Your father's saying is a good one. My old teacher—"
"Court or Vene?"
"Court. He used to tell us that a one-eyed man sees flat. It takes two eyes, set a little apart from each other, to see things as they really are. So I go with him. Make the boy a friend, if that seems natural. He seems likely enough."
"Yeah,"
Jake said briefly, but the color was going down in his cheeks again. Roland was pleased to see this. "Spend tomorrow with him, and his friends if he has a gang he goes about with." Jake shook his head.
"It's far out in the country. Ben says that Eisenhart's got plenty of help around the place, and there are some kids his age, but he's not allowed to play with them, because he's the foreman's son, I guess."
Roland nodded. This did not surprise him. "You'll be offered graft tonight in the pavilion. Do you need me to tell you it's iced tea once we're past the first toast?" Jake shook his head.
Roland touched his temple, his lips, the corner of one eye, his lips again. Head clear, mouth shut, see much, say little.
Jake grinned briefly and gave him a thumbs up.
"What about you?"
"The three of us will stay with the priest tonight. I'm in hopes that tomorrow we may hear his tale."
"And see."
They had fallen a bit behind the others, but Jake still lowered his voice.
"See what he told us about?"
"That I don't know," Roland said. "The day after tomorrow, we three will ride out to the Rocking Bee. Perhaps noon with Cy Eisenhart and have a bit of palaver. Then, over the next few days, the four of us will have a look at this town, both the inner and the outer. If things go well for you at the ranch, Jake, I'd have you stay there as long as you like and as much as they'll have you."
"Really?"
Although he kept his face well, as the saying went, the gunslinger thought Jake was very pleased by this.
"Aye. From what I make out, what I can, there's three big bugs in Calla Bryn Sturgis. Overholzer's one. Took, the storekeeper, is another. The third one's Eisenhart. I'd hear what you make of him with great interest."
"You'll hear," Jake said. "And thank you, Cy."
He tapped his throat three times. Then his seriousness broke into a broad grin, a boy's grin. He urged his horse into a trot, moving up to tell his new friend that yes, he might stay the night. Yes, he could come and play.
4.
"Holy wow," Eddie said. The words came out low and slow, almost the exclamation of an awestruck cartoon character. But after nearly 2 months in the woods, the view warranted an exclamation. And there was the element of surprise. At one moment, they'd just been clopping along the forest trail, mostly by twos. Overholzer rode alone at the head of the group, Roland alone at its tail. At the next, the trees were gone, and the land itself fell away to the north, south, and east. They were thus presented with a sudden, breathtaking, stomach-dropping view of the town whose children they were supposed to save. Yet at first,
Eddie had no eyes at all for what was spread out directly below him, and when he glanced at Susanna and Jake, he saw they were also looking beyond the collar. Eddie didn't have to look around at Roland to know he was looking beyond, too. Definition of a wanderer, Eddie thought. A guy who's always looking beyond.
"Aye, quite the view, we tell the gods thanky," Overholzer said complacently, and then, with a glance at Callahan, "Man Jesus as well, of course. All gods is one when it comes to thanks, so I've heard, and 'tis a good enough saying."
He might have prattled on. Probably did. When you were the big farmer, you usually got to have your say and all the way to the end. Eddie took no notice. He had returned his attention to the view. Ahead of him, beyond the village, was a gray band of river running south. The branch of the big river known as Divar Titihwai, Eddie remembered. Where it came out of the forest, the Divar Titi ran between steep banks, but they lowered as the river entered the first cultivated fields, then fell away entirely. He saw a few stands of palm trees, green and improbably tropical. Beyond the moderate-sized village, the land west of the river was a brilliant green shot through everywhere with more gray. Eddie was sure that on a sunny day, that gray would turn a brilliant blue, and that when the sun was directly overhead, the glare would be too bright to look at. He was looking at rice fields. Or maybe you called them paddies. Beyond them and east of the river was desert, stretching for miles. Eddie could see parallel scratches of metal running into it and made them for railroad tracks. And beyond the desert, or obscuring the rest of it, was simple blackness. It rose into the sky like a vapory wall, seeming to cut into the low-hanging clouds.
"Jan's thunderclapsai," Zelia Jafford said.
Eddie nodded.
"Land of the wolves, and God knows what else."
"You're a bugger," Slightman the younger said. He was trying to sound bluff and matter-of-fact, but to Eddie he looked plenty scared, maybe on the verge of tears. But the wolves wouldn't take him. Surely, if your twin died, that made you a singleton by default, didn't it? Well, it had certainly worked for Elvis Presley. But of course the king hadn't come from Calla Bryn Sturgis, or even Calla Lockwood to the south.
"Nah, the king was a Mississippi boy," Eddie said low.
Tian turned in his saddle to look at him.
"Beg your pardon, Si."
Eddie, not aware that he'd spoken aloud, said,
"I'm sorry. I was talking to myself."
Andy, the messenger robot, many other functions, came striding back up the path from ahead of them in time to hear this.
"Those who hold conversation with themselves keep sorry company. This is an old saying of the Kalasai, Eddie. Don't take it personally, I beg. And as I've said before, and will undoubtedly say again, you can't get snot off a suede jacket, my friend. An old saying from Calla Bryn, Brooklyn."
Andy's innards clicked. His blue eyes flashed.
"Snot. Mucus from the nose. Also, a disrespectful or supercilious person. Suede. This is a leather product which—"
"Never mind, Andy," Susanna said. "My friend is just being silly. He does this quite frequently."
"Oh, yes," Andy said. "He is a child of winter. Would you like me to tell your horoscope, Susanna Sai? You will meet a handsome man. You will have two ideas, one bad and one good. You will have a dark-haired—"
"Get out of here, idiot," Overholzer said. "Right into town, straight line, no wandering. Check that all's well at the pavilion. No one wants to hear your goddamned horoscopes. Begging your pardon, old fellow."
Callahan made no reply. Andy bowed, tapped his metal throat three times, and set off down the trail, which was steep but comfortingly wide. Susanna watched him go with what might have been relief.
"Kind of hard on him, weren't you?" Eddie asked.
"He's but a piece of machinery," Overholzer said, breaking the last word into syllables, as if speaking to a child.
"And he can be annoying," Tian said. "But tell me, Size, what do you think of our Calla?"
Roland eased his horse in between Eddie's and Callahan's.
"It's very beautiful," he said. "Whatever the gods may be, they have favored this place. I see corn, sharp root, beans, and potatoes. Are those potatoes?"
"Aye, spuds, do you?"
Slightman said, clearly pleased by Roland's eye.
"And yon's all that gorgeous rice," Roland said.
All small holds by the river, Tian said, where the water's sweet and slow. And we know how lucky we are. When the rice comes ready, either to plant or to harvest, all the women go together. They're singing in the fields and even dancing.
Come, come, Kamala, Roland said. At least that was what Eddie heard.
Tian and Zelia brightened with surprise and recognition. The Slightmans exchanged a glance and grinned.
Where did you hear the rice song? The elder asked. When?
In my home, said Roland. Long ago. Come, come, Kamala, rice come afala.
He pointed to the west, away from the river. There's the biggest farm, deep in wheat. Yours, Cy Overholzer?
So it is, say thank you.
And beyond, to the south, more farms. And then the ranches, that one's cattle, that one's sheep, that one cattle, more sheep.
How can you tell the difference from so far away? Susanna asked.
Sheep eat the grass closer to the earth, Lady Cy, Overholzer said. So where you see the light brown patches of earth, that's sheep graze land. The others, what you'd call ochre, I guess, that's cattle graze.
Eddie thought of all the Western movies he'd seen at the Majestic. Clint Eastwood, Paul Newman, Robert Redford, Lee Van Cleef.
In my land they tell legends of range wars between the ranchers and the sheep farmers, he said, because it was told the sheep ate the grass too close, took even the roots, you can, so it wouldn't grow back again.
That's plain silly, beg your pardon, Overholzer said. Sheep do crop grass close eye, but then we send the cows over it to water. The manure they drop is full of seed.
Ah, Eddie said. He couldn't think of anything else.
Put that way, the whole idea of range wars seemed exquisitely stupid.
Come on, Overholzer said. Daylight's wasting, do you? And there's a feast laid on for us at the pavilion. The whole town will be there to meet you.
And to give us a good looking over, too, Eddie thought.
Lead on, Roland said. We can be there by late day. Or am I wrong?
Nope,
Overholzer said, then drove his feet into his horse's sides and yanked its head around. Just looking at this made Eddie wince. He headed down the path. The others followed. 5. Eddie never forgot their first encounter with those of the Kala. That was one memory always within easy reach. Because everything that happened had been a surprise, he supposed, and when everything's a surprise, experience takes on a dreamlike quality. He remembered the way the torches changed when the speaking was done, their strange, varied light. He remembered Oi's unexpected salute to the crowd, the upturned faces and his suffocating panic and his anger at Roland. Susanna hoisting herself onto the piano bench in what the locals called the musica. Oh, yeah, that memory always, you bet. But even more vivid than this memory of his beloved was that of the gunslinger, of Roland dancing. But before any of these things came the ride down the Kala's high street and his sense of foreboding, his premonition of bad days on the way.
6.
They reached the town proper an hour before sunset. The clouds parted and let through the day's last red light. The street was empty. The surface was oiled dirt. The horse's hooves made muffled thuds on the wheel-marked hardpack. Eddie saw a livery stable, a place called the Traveler's Rest that seemed a combination lodging house and eating house, and, at the far end of the street, a large two-story that just about had to be the Kala's gathering hall. Off to the right of this was the flare of torches, so he supposed there were people waiting there, but at the north end of town, where they entered, there were none. The silence and the empty board sidewalks began to give Eddie the creeps. He remembered Roland's tale of Susan's final ride into Mages in the back of a cart, standing with her hands tied in front of her and a noose around her neck. Her road had been empty, too, at first. Then, not far from the intersection of the Great Road and the Silk Ranch Road, Susan and her captors had passed a single farmer, a man with what Roland had called lamb slaughterer's eyes. Later, she would be pelted with vegetables and sticks, even with stones.
but this lone farmer had been first, standing there with his handful of corn shucks, which he had tossed almost gently at her as she passed on her way to, well, on her way to Charyu Tree, the reap fair of the old people. As they rode into Calabrin Sturgis, Eddie kept expecting that man, those lamb slaughterer's eyes, and the handful of corn shucks. Because this town felt bad to him, not evil. Evil as Magus had likely been on the night of Susan Delgado's death, but bad in a simpler way. Bad as in bad luck, bad choices, bad omens. Bad Ka, maybe. He leaned toward Sleitman the Elder.
"Where in the heck is everyone, Ben?"
"Yonder," Sleitman said, and pointed to the flare of the torches.
"Why are they so quiet?" Jake asked.
"They don't know what to expect," Callahan said. "We're cut off here. The outsiders we do see from time to time are the occasional peddler, harrier, gambler. Oh, and the lake boat marts sometimes stop in high summer."
"What's a lake boat mart?" Susanna asked.
Callahan described a wide, flatboat, paddle-wheel-driven and gaily painted, covered with small shops. These made their slow way down the Divar Titihuai, stopping to trade at the kalas of the Middle Crescent until their goods were gone. "Shoddy stuff for the most part," Callahan said, but Eddie wasn't sure he trusted him entirely, at least on the subject of the lake boat marts. He spoke with the almost unconscious distaste of the long-time religious.
"And the other outsiders come to steal their children," Callahan concluded.
He pointed to the left, where a long wooden building seemed to take up almost half the high street. Eddie counted not two hitching rails or four, but eight long ones.
"Took's General Store, may it do you fine," Callahan said, with what might have been sarcasm.
They reached the pavilion. Eddie later put the number present at 700 or 800, but when he first saw them, a mass of hats and bonnets and boots and work-roughened hands beneath the long red light of that day's evening sun, the crowd seemed enormous, untellable. "They will throw shit at us," he thought. "Throw shit at us and yell Charyu Tree." The idea was ridiculous, but also strong. The Kala folk moved back on two sides, creating an aisle of green grass which led to a raised wooden platform. Ringing the pavilion were torches caught in iron cages. At that point, they still all flared a quite ordinary yellow. Eddie's nose caught the strong reek of oil. Overholzer dismounted. So did the others of his party. Eddie, Susanna, and Jake looked at Roland. Roland sat as he was for a moment, leaning slightly forward, one arm cast across the pommel of his saddle, seeming lost in his own thoughts. Then he took off his hat and held it out to the crowd. He tapped his throat three times. The crowd murmured in appreciation or surprise, and he couldn't tell. Not anger, though. Definitely not anger, and that was good. The gunslinger lifted one booted foot across the saddle and lightly dismounted. Eddie left his horse more carefully, aware of all the eyes on him. He'd put on Susanna's harness earlier, and now he stood next to her mount, back too. She slipped into the harness with the ease of long practice. The crowd murmured again when they saw her legs were missing from just above the knees.
Overholzer started briskly up the path, shaking a few hands along the way. Callahan walked directly behind him, occasionally sketching the sign of the cross in the air. Other hands reached out of the crowd to secure the horses. Roland, Eddie, and Jake walked three abreast. Oi was still in the wide front pocket of the poncho Benny had loaned Jake, looking about with interest.
Eddie realized he could actually smell the crowd. Sweat and hair and sunburned skin and the occasional splash of what the characters in the Western movies usually called, with contempt similar to Callahan's for the lake boat marts, foo-foo water. He could also smell food, pork and beef, fresh bread, frying onions, coffee and graff. His stomach rumbled, yet he wasn't hungry. No, not really hungry. The idea that the path they were walking would disappear and these people would close in on them wouldn't leave his mind. They were so quiet. Somewhere close by, he could hear the first nightjars and whippoorwills tuning up for evening. Overholser and Callahan mounted the platform. Eddie was alarmed to see that none of the others of the party which had ridden out to meet them did. Roland walked up the three broad wooden steps without hesitation, however. Eddie followed, conscious that his knees were a little weak.
"You all right?"
Susanna murmured in his ear. "So far." To the left of the platform was a round stage with seven men on it, all dressed in white shirts, blue jeans, and sashes. Eddie recognized the instruments they were holding, and although the mandolin and banjo made him think their music would probably be of the shit-kicking variety, the sight of them was still reassuring. They didn't hire bands to play at human sacrifices, did they? Maybe just a drummer or two, to wind up the spectators. Eddie turned to face the crowd, with Susanna on his back. He was dismayed to see that the aisle that had begun where the high street ended was indeed gone now, faces tilted up to look at him. Women and men, old and young. No expression on those faces, and no children among them. These were faces that spent most of their time out in the sun and had the cracks to prove it. That sense of foreboding would not leave him. Overholser stopped beside a plain wooden table. On it was a large, billowy feather. The farmer took it and held it up. The crowd, quiet to begin with, now fell into a silence so disquietingly deep that Eddie could hear the rattling rails in some old party's chest as he or she breathed.
"Put me down, Eddie," Susanna said quietly.
He didn't like to, but he did.
"I'm Wayne Overholser of 7 Mile Farm," Overholser said, stepping to the edge of the stage with the feather held before him. "Hear me now, I beg."
"We say thank you, Si," they murmured.
Overholser turned and held one hand out to Roland and his tet, standing there in their travel-stained clothes. Susanna didn't stand exactly, but rested between Eddie and Jake on her haunches and one propped hand. Eddie thought he had never felt himself studied more eagerly.
"We men of the Kala heard T. and Jeffords, George Telford, Diego Adams, and all others who would speak at the gathering hall," Overholser said. "There I did speak myself. They'll come and take the children," I said, meaning the wolves, of course. "Then they'll leave us alone again for a generation or more. So 'tis, so it's been. I say leave it alone." I think now those words were, mayhap, a little hasty.
A murmur from the crowd, soft as a breeze.
"At this same meeting we heard Per Callahan say there were gunslingers north of us."
Another murmur. This one was a little louder. Gunslingers, Mid-World, Gilead.
"It was taken among us that a party should go and see. These are the folk we found, do you? They claim to be what Per Callahan said they were."
Overholser now looked uncomfortable, almost as if he were suppressing a fart. Eddie had seen this expression before, mostly on TV, when politicians, faced with some fact they couldn't squirm around, were forced to backtrack.
"They claim to be of the gone world, which is to say..."
"Go on, Wayne," Eddie thought. "Get it out, you can do it."
"Which is to say of Eld's line."
"Gods be praised," some woman shrieked. "Gods have sent him to save our babby, so they have."
There were shushing sounds. Overholser waited for quiet with a pained look on his face, then went on.
"They can speak for themselves, and must. But I've seen enough to believe they may be able to help us with our problem. They carry good guns, you see 'em, and they can use 'em. Set my watch and warrant on it and say thank you."
This time the murmur from the crowd was louder, and Eddie sensed goodwill in it. He relaxed a little.
"All right, then. Let him stand before A one by one, that he might hear their voices and see their faces very well. This is their din."
He lifted a hand to Roland. The gunslinger stepped forward. The red sun set his left cheek on fire. The right was painted yellow with torch glow. He put out one leg. The thunk of the worn boot heel on the boards was very clear in the silence. Eddie, for no reason, thought of a fist knocking on a coffin top. He bowed deeply, open palms held out to them.
"Roland of Gilead, son of Stephen," he said. "The line of Eld." They sighed. "May we be well met."
He stepped back and glanced at Eddie.
This part he could do.
"Eddie Dean of New York," he said, "son of Wendell."
At least that's what Ma always claimed, he thought. And then, unaware he was going to say it,
"The line of Eld, the Cotet of 19.
He stepped back, and Susanna moved forward to the edge of the platform. Back straight, looking out at them calmly, she said,
"I am Susanna Dean, wife of Eddie, daughter of Dan, the line of Eld, the Cotet of 19. May we be well met and do you fine."
She curtsied, holding out her pretend skirts. At this, there was both laughter and applause. While she spoke her piece, Roland bent to whisper a brief something in Jake's ear. Jake nodded and then stepped forward confidently. He looked very young and very handsome in the Day's End light. He put out his foot and bowed over it. The poncho swung comically forward with Oi's weight.
"I am Jake Chambers, son of Elmer, the line of Eld, the Cotet of the 99.
99? Eddie looked at Susanna, who offered him a very small shrug. What's this 99 shit? Then he thought, what the hell? He didn't know what the Cotet of 19 was either, and he'd said it himself. But Jake wasn't done. He lifted Oi from the pocket of Benny Slightman's poncho. The crowd murmured at the sight of him. Jake gave Roland a quick glance. "Are you sure?" it asked, and Roland nodded. At first, Eddie didn't think Jake's furry pal was going to do anything. The people of the Kala, the Falcon, had gone completely quiet again, so quiet that once again the even song of the birds could be heard clearly. Then Oi rose up on his rear legs, stuck one of them forward, and actually bowed over it. He wavered but kept his balance. His little black paws were held out with the palms up, like Roland's. There were gasps, laughter, applause. Jake looked thunderstruck.
"Oi," said the bumbler. "Eld. Thank'ee."
Each word, clear. He held the bow a moment longer, then dropped onto all fours and scurried briskly back to Jake's side. The applause was thunderous. In one brilliant, simple stroke, Roland, for who else, Eddie thought, could have taught the bumbler to do that, had made these people into their friends and admirers. For tonight, at least. So that was the first surprise. Oi, bowing to the assembled Kala Falcon and declaring himself en tête with his traveling mates. The second came hard on its heels.
"I'm no speaker," Roland said, stepping forward again. "My tongue tangles worse than a drunk's on reap night. But Eddie will set us on with a word, I'm sure."
This was Eddie's turn to be thunderstruck. Below them, the crowd applauded and stomped appreciatively on the ground. There were cries of "Thank'ee, Si," and "Speak you well," and "Hear him, hear him." Even the band got into the act, playing a flourish that was ragged but loud. He had time to shoot Roland a single, frantic, furious look. "What in the blue fuck are you doing to me?" The gunslinger looked back blandly, then folded his arms across his chest. The applause was fading. So was his anger. It was replaced by terror. Overholzer was watching him with interest, arms crossed in conscious or unconscious imitation of Roland. Below him, Eddie could see a few individual faces at the front of the crowd, the Slightmans, the Jaffers's. He looked in the other direction, and there was Callahan, blue eyes narrowed. Above them, the ragged cruciform scar on his forehead seemed to glare.
"What the hell am I supposed to say to them?"
"Better say something, Eds," his brother Henry spoke up. "They're waiting."
"Cry your pardon if I'm a little slow getting started," he said. "We've come miles and wheels and more miles and wheels, and you're the first folks we've seen in many a..."
"Many a what? Week? Month? Year? Decade?" Eddie laughed. To himself, he sounded like the world's biggest idiot, a fellow who couldn't be trusted to hold his own dick at watering time, let alone a gun.
"In many a blue moon."
They laughed at that, and hard. Some even applauded. He had touched the town's funny bone without even realizing it. He relaxed. And when he did, he found himself speaking quite naturally. It occurred to him, just in passing, that not so long ago, the armed gunslinger standing in front of these 700 frightened, hopeful people had been sitting in front of the TV in nothing but a pair of yellowing underpants, eating Cheetos, done up on heroin, and watching Yogi Bear. "We've come from afar," he said, "and have far yet to go. Our time here will be short, but we'll do what we can. Hear me, I beg." "Say on, stranger," someone called. "You speak fair." "Yeah?" Eddie thought. "News to me, fella." A few cries of "I" and "Do ya." "The healers in my barony have a saying," Eddie told them. "First, do no harm." He wasn't sure if this was a lawyer motto or a doctor motto, but he'd heard it in quite a few movies and TV shows, and it sounded pretty good. "We would do no harm here, do you, Ken? But no one ever pulled a bullet or even a splinter from under a kid's fingernail without spilling some blood." There were murmurs of agreement. Overholzer, however, was poker-faced, and in the crowd Eddie saw looks of doubt. He felt a surprising flush of anger. He had no right to be angry at these people, who had done them absolutely no harm and had refused them absolutely nothing, at least so far. But he was, just the same. "We've got another saying in the barony of New York," he told them. "There ain't no free lunch. From what we know of your situation, it's serious. Standing up against these wolves would be dangerous, but sometimes doing nothing just makes people feel sick and hungry." "Hear him, hear him," the same someone at the back of the crowd called out. Eddie saw Andy the robot back there. And near him, a large wagon full of men in voluminous cloaks of either black or dark blue. Eddie assumed that these were the Manny folk. "We'll look around," Eddie said, "and once we understand the problem, we'll see what can be done. If we think the answer's nothing, we'll tip our hats to you and move along." Two or three rows back stood a man in a battered white cowboy hat. He had shaggy white eyebrows and a white mustache to match. Eddie thought he looked quite a bit like Pa Cartwright on that old TV show Bonanza. This version of the Cartwright patriarch looked less than thrilled with what Eddie was saying. "If we can help, we'll help," he said. His voice was utterly flat now. "But we won't do it alone, folks. Hear me, I beg. Hear me very well. You better be ready to stand up for what you want. You better be ready to fight for the things you'd keep." With that, he stuck out a foot in front of him. The moccasin he wore didn't produce the same fist-on-coffin-top thud. But Eddie thought of it all the same and bowed. There was dead silence. Then Tian Jeffords began to clap. Zelia joined him. Benny also applauded. His father nudged him, but the boy went on clapping, and after a moment, Sleitman the Elder joined in. Eddie gave Roland a burning look. Roland's own bland expression didn't change. Susanna tugged the leg of his pants, and Eddie bent to her.
"You did fine, sugar."
"No thanks to him." Eddie nodded at Roland. But now that it was over, he felt surprisingly good. And talking was really not Roland's thing, Eddie knew that. He could do it when he had no backup, but he didn't care for it.
"So now you know what you are," he thought. "Roland of Gilead's mouthpiece. And yet was that so bad? Hadn't Cuthbert Allgood had the job long before him?"
Callahan stepped forward.
"Perhaps we could set them on a bit better than we have, my friends. Give them a proper Calabrin Sturgis welcome."
He began to applaud. The gathered folkin joined in immediately this time. The applause was long and lusty. There were cheers, whistles, stamping feet, the foot stamping a little less than satisfying without a wood floor to amplify the sound. The musical combo played not just one flourish, but a whole series of them. Susanna grasped one of Eddie's hands, Jake grasped the other, the four of them bowed like some rock group at the end of a particularly good set, and the applause redoubled. At last Callahan quieted it by raising his hands.
"Serious work ahead, folks," he said. "Serious things to think about, serious things to do. But for now, let's eat. Later, let's dance and sing and be merry.
They began to applaud again, and Callahan quieted them again.
"Enough!" he cried, laughing. "And you, Manny, at the back, I know you haul your own rations, but there's no reason on earth for you not to eat and drink what you have with us. Join us, do you? May it do you fine."
May it do us all fine, Eddie thought. And still that sense of foreboding wouldn't leave him. It was like a guest standing on the outskirts of the party, just beyond